Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Erica Forensic, author of The River at Night, published just last month by Scout Press, which is an imprint of Simon & Schuster. Erica is a graduate of the MFA program in creative writing at BU. Her work has appeared in Salon, the Boston Globe, on NPR, and you can find out more about her work on her website. The River at Night is a book about four approaching, barely approaching, middle-aged women on a regular annual girls' weekend off trip that turns out to be anything but regular. Pia is the uber woman of the group. She's tall, beautiful, sexy, athletic. She sets up this hyper-dangerous vacation that seems just the ticket for Winnie, who has a dead-end job, a failed marriage, and the loss of a brother to deal with. Sandra and Rachel, their other two friends, are also along for what is an extremely bumpy ride. And despite the emotional chasms that develop and fractures that develop during the trip, cooperation is required amongst the women in order to navigate the dangers of the river that they're on and to maneuver and build confidence with each other. But there's all kinds of things that go on, and there's all kinds of unexpected tragedy as well. And there's a lot of struggling for survival. And it's a fascinating book because you don't usually see this type of adventure, like movies like The Bear or something like that, with four women, strong women protagonists, and you do here. So it'll be fun to talk about. So welcome, Erica, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Tim. This is great. Appreciate it.
Well, let's start out by getting James Dickey out of the way, okay?
Okay, sure.
Okay, go ahead.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, I had two big influences on this book. One was reading James Dickey's book, Deliverance, his 1970, you know, masterpiece. I mean, most people have seen the movie, you know, cue the banjos, et cetera. But the book, I mean, he was a poet, and the book is fantastic. So I was inspired by that book. It's visceral, it's propulsive, and these four men just make one mistake after the next, and I don't know, most people know the story. So that was a big influence on me. And I thought, why not four women, and why not take, you know, the maelstrom that's, you know, female friendship and put it in the Allagash territory of northern Maine?
Oh, yeah.
That's
the second part of the influence, was you actually participated in a trip like this yourself.
Well, I've whitewater rafted five times. I really never need to do it again. but that same month that I read Deliverance, I went on a hiking trip with some girlfriends, and the one that had planned the trip didn't do a good job, so there was way too much mountain and not enough daylight. So you know, we all survived, obviously, but it was hairy. It really was. And you know, one woman got terrible cramps in her legs. We had to massage her calves and hamstrings so she could walk. Another guy was really tall and had this enormous pack, and he was a bit elderly. I was like, we're gonna carry this guy. I mean, so yeah. I just thought, why not? I mean, I wanted to write a book I wanted to read, you know, and there was nothing out there like this, so I thought I would do it.
There really isn't any, but it's really funny. I kind of interrupted you, but you were saying, you know, you decided to put four women together. I mean, do you think at first when I started reading it, and first thing, you know, when you're interviewing as many authors as I interview, you know, you go, okay, would I read this book because I'm thinking it's like chick lit?
And yeah,
so,
of course.
Right, yeah. So I'm initially going to be, although the cover is great because the cover appeals to everybody. I like the cover a lot, don't you?
I love the cover. Well, there's the British cover, which is really striking in its own way, but I imagine you have the American one.
And, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like you're in the water, you know, it's like very tactile, you know, and
you're in the water, and it's also like you can't get out of the water, you know what I mean? It gives you that feeling,
yes,
like you're kind of trapped like sheep, like Winnie gets a couple of times. But
yeah.
But the cool thing about it is sometimes publishers will market a book as if it is chick lit, and then there would be four girls on the cover, and then guys wouldn't pick it up, and they wouldn't want to read it on an airplane or something. You know what I mean?
Well, you kind of nailed that, because they had a lot of different color covers that they were looking at. And at first, and you know, one of the covers had four women on a raft, and that got struck down because it was like, well, it's more than that, you know. And so this was the one that was chosen, and I'm you know, they'll be super happy to hear about your response. I mean, I love it now too. I mean, it's totally my favorite.
Yeah, it draws you in, and then at first, if you're a guy, kind of a just a normal jackass kind of guy like me.
That's my audience, all the jackass guys.
That's right. That's what you get. Well, pretty much that's pretty much includes all men of all types.
Yeah, you said it, I didn't.
No, it's true. Why? No, well, the way I look at it, women are crazy and men are jackasses. That's my take on life.
That's called culture.
But yeah, first you're going, well, how the heck are these four going to survive? As a guy, you're thinking that, well, I could do it, but there's no way they can do it. But then as you move on into the book and they adapt, not voluntarily, but by necessity, certain survival skills, you start seeing it as, you know, realistically, yeah, they could actually accomplish some of this stuff. And I don't want to do a lot of spoilers, but something happens initially that makes it so they pretty much have to rely on themselves. You can do spoilers if you want, but I won't do them.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the funny thing about like Goodreads and Amazon, it's like if you read all those reviews, you really don't need to read the book.
That's
true. I mean, that's kind of the trend right now. I guess they'll tell the story now. But yeah, well, there's an accident and they lose the raft. I mean, and you know, they have to decide where to go from there.
Yeah. Did you ever think that? When you did it, did you know as you were riding along with them on the river, did you know how it was going to come out when you started it? Did you already have it planned out?
I never write a novel anymore without knowing exactly what's going to happen, because I have about five, you know, sort of aborted attempts in my drawer of novels. I mean, I've been writing for 30 years, and I just don't have the time for that anymore. I think it's like building a house. You need a blueprint. I don't know how people do it. You know, I think it's great if you can write a book without an outline, but I can't go down that road anymore. You know,
it is. It's hard to do it that way, and it's hard not to do it that way. I was talking to, I think Amor Towles, the guy who wrote The Rules of Civility and A Gentleman in Moscow,
mm-hmm.
and he was saying, I said, I'm surprised this guy juggled, and he goes, I didn't know he juggled. I didn't know he juggled until I wrote it. And
right.
There's a lot of authors that are like that, that, you know, I didn't know this, you know, he told me he did this. But
yeah, well, you know, my characters definitely speak to me and they develop as the book goes along, but sort of the big turning points I need to know, the reversals, the reveals, well, that's like sort of screenwriting lingo. I was a screenwriter before I wrote this.
And it's a very cinematic book. It can easily, well, look, just like Deliverance was turned into an incredible movie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was a painter, and so I've always thought visually, and then screenwriting, and, you know, actually writing screenplays taught me the three-act structure. I resisted it. I don't know why.
Oh, yeah, but you also stuck yourself in there, too, because, like, when Winnie puts her paints away, you know? It's like you put your paints away, right?
I did. Very good. See, I forgot. I forget everything I've written. No, I'm just kidding. It's like, but that's a very keen observation. Yes, I did.
Yes.
I sure did. I put my paints away. I was 28 years old. I woke up. I was like, I don't care about painting anymore. I want to be a writer.
But then at the end, when he goes back to it, so maybe you'll go back to it. Who knows?
Well, you know, the reason I have these moments where I want to, but I have too much respect for how much work everything takes, and I'm afraid to start that because writing just takes everything from me, you know, in a good way, and sometimes, you know, I just want to be really good at it and continue, you know, to write something. I want to write something with as much of myself as I put into this book, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And it's funny, too, when you're talking about reveals and things like that and how this might play out, you know, because you kind of, when you read this kind of book, you kind of cast it in your mind as you, the reader, not you, but the reader, and maybe you too, but the reader, as he's reading, he kind of casts it in his mind because you really are watching this movie in your head. Some books not, some books yes, and I'm not saying good or bad for either of them, but in this book you can kind of see what's going on, you can kind of feel it, you can kind of taste it and smell it, and so you do tend to like kind of cast about, no pun intended, for who might be in the movie, and I found myself doing that a lot. But it's funny that you talk about the reveals and things because, you know, there's some added bonus characters in this book that pop up, and, you know, you really, the reader doesn't really expect them at all. So all that was, you had that all outlined on a nice piece of paper? You had everything outlined?
Well, yeah. I mean, I actually had something like 50 pages of notes. Sorry about that. I don't know what that was.
That's okay. I had
an outline, and then I had about, like I said, about 50 pages of notes. And I, you know, character studies, just banged out, you know, just basics. You know, obviously, yeah, you do have to leave some room for the story to come alive as you're writing it. So, yeah, I mean, I definitely leave myself that. I don't know, I certainly don't know everything before I go into it. You know what I mean? I have to, in order to write the words, I have to literally go into sort of this weird trance and be there. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. In fact,
I literally need to be there. And so how can I bring you there? How in the world can I bring you there if I don't go there? And if I don't feel those things and have those emotions, and sometimes they're painful, you know, emotions. You know, with other books I've written, I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to do this rewrite because I have to feel this pain again. Well, if I don't feel this pain again, I can't write this. I can't polish this scene, you know.
Yeah.
So that's why it's this, you know, kind of enormous amount of work.
Also, there's some, I always like it, and I think readers do like it when there's things that, not red herrings, but things like that throw you off the track a little bit. Like in the beginning, when they're in the store getting supplies and that guy's behind the counter and the other guy comes in and, you know, says that Rory shouldn't be on the river because it doesn't belong to him and he has no right and all that. I thought for sure that guy was coming back.
Yeah.
I was
Everybody does. Well, I mean, so that's why, you know, that's kind of a screenwriting technique too. You know, it's like, okay, so you've set it up to go one way. You know, the reader is 10 times smarter as they're reading than you are. Your audience is thinking ahead. When you're, like, for example, when you're watching a movie, you're not aware of it, but you are so far ahead of that movie. What's going to happen? What do you know so far? What are the possibilities? And so it's very, you know, part of the screenwriter and author's job is to surprise you, you know, delight you, bring you someplace you weren't expect. Why would you want to go where you're expected to? You were going to go.
Some people do. Some people read books designed exactly like that. So at the very end, they're wrapped up in a box and, you know, gift wrapped and then tied with a bow. And then other readers.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I have total respect for that kind of writing. It's, once again, it's, I want to read something, I want to write something that I would like to read. So I guess, you know, and, but like you said, no, there's no, it's not, well, you know, there's no use confusing anyone. And there's a fine line. You don't want to confuse people or piss them off. You know, I mean, I've read so many books of, like, what's this doing here and why? You know, it's like Chekhov's gun. You don't show a gun in the first chapter, and where'd the friggin' gun go? I mean, what? You know, so there does need to be a reason for, there needs to be a reason for what's in your story.
Hey, so.
Why is it there? I mean, that's, again, screenwriting. I know I'm a broken record, but. Every chapter needs a should have a.
It's just really.
There should be a reason for it being there.
It's just really disciplined. I mean, it's, you know, it's a, you have a really disciplined approach, and a lot of the authors, I would say the minority of the authors I interview have that discipline and approach. The majority are just kind of I don't mean that they're winging it in the slightest, but they seem as if they don't outline it like you do. And I know I'm the same way when I write. My problem is I'm fine with narrative, I'm fine with exposition, with dialogue, but I don't have a story. I don't have a beginning, middle.
Story is very hard. I mean, people underestimate how hard it is to come up with a good story. I mean, you know, and it is, and for as much as for as much as we're so in love with story, and I think that our brains respond at some primal level to story, it's very hard to come up with a really good story that has all the elements that that please an audience. But again, you know, I'm coming from, you know, 30 years of writing, and as I said, you know, screenplay background, it's very, very disciplined. And again, I guess I'm just very, I mean, my goal is to create entertainment, and I guess that's part and parcel of how I define entertainment for me. I also enjoy a book if the writing's really beautiful and the story's, you know, good enough, quote unquote. I'll go along with it and I'll appreciate it on a different level or on another level.
Yeah, it sounds like sometimes, you know, it depends on who. I guess when I was interviewing Jodi Picoult, who she also came to our bookstore and did a signing, she approaches it in a similar fashion too. And she's looking at it as, you know, she's not trying to, you know, she says, I don't necessarily have to be an intellectual. I don't have to do this. And I do want to entertain. That's what I'm there for. But her research is, you know, impeccable and incredible. And she does exactly like you do. She has it all. She knows what she's going to write when she puts the pen to the paper. And
well, I mean, I think that the older you get, the more you realize you don't have time unfolding before you forever.
Yeah, I know. Tell me
and
about
so
it.
You feel like, well, how am I going to best use my time? And to write a 70, 80,000 word book, and especially if you have a publisher and you've signed a contract, you know, it's like, okay, better count backward here and see what I need when, in order to submit a finished product at a certain date. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, you have to. Okay, it's like I'm going to build a house, so.
Right. Yeah.
First, I need a blueprint. Then I'm going to buy the materials. Then by like July, I need to have the basement poured or what? You know what? I'm making this crazy.
No. Actually, it's a really good way of putting it. I haven't heard it put that way, but
yeah,
it's very true. But then again, you know, like there are some things that I would like. Okay, here's one thing that I thought when I was reading the book. I was going, why did you make Pia all that? I mean, she is so all that. You know, I was thinking, okay, she could have made her like pretty, sexy, hot. But you made her like incredibly over the top that way, which was impressive, and I liked it a lot. But I couldn't quite figure out why you decided to approach it that way. So tell me about that.
I've never heard anyone say that she was all that. Well, I thought that you mean she was all that physically?
Yeah, physically and on the surface, so emotionally secure in herself, and which I won't go into the spoilers about that either. But. On the surface, you made her seem like this, like I said in the beginning, like this uber woman, you know, this alpha female.
Mm. Well, the way I saw Pia was, she's beautiful and tall and lovely and very athletic, but her thinking is rather limited in the fact that, I mean, you know, she's driving up with the rest of the women saying, I'm going to live off the land, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. You know, and when he's thinking, you know, you like your stuff, you know, you like your things, and you're kind of full of, you know, and then, you know, she has this idea of who she wants to be and what she wants to do, but I guess like so many of us, we don't really have a concrete idea of really what that is, you know. I mean, she's a sneaker saleswoman. She's not exactly living at some level of achievement or something. But not that there's anything wrong with being a sneaker saleswoman. But if you're an unhappy sneaker saleswoman...
You just eliminated all the sneaker saleswomen from possible...
All right, I'm sorry, sneaker saleswomen. I know. But, you know, like all of us, I mean, I don't know. I saw her as a little bit naive, really naive, actually. And a little bit, you know, I don't want to give too much of the story away, but, you know, kind of insensitive and, you know, just bringing these women on this trip that really had not been vetted.
I'm surprised Winnie went. I was surprised at the beginning. I was surprised she went. You know, I was like, I mean, I knew she had to go because I wouldn't be reading a book. But, I mean, it was like, I really thought, well, you know, she should think better. She should think better of this.
That's why I took pains to make her put her in a vulnerable situation. She'd lost her brother. She was on a dead end job. She had lost her her marriage. I mean, I guess this goes back to the power of female friendship, and how you know. I think you ask any. I'm telling you, the yearly trip for women is an absolute institution. I challenge you to swing a dead cat. You don't hit someone, a woman who is like, oh yeah, every year I go with my friends. I'm saying not every woman on earth, my God, but I mean, perhaps it's an American thing, but it's also, it is kind of a thing that we do so that we can, you know, really have that time for, you know, often very, very intimate conversations, and we process the year and go forward into the next.
Do you still do it?
I do. Not every year, because my women friends are kind of far flung, so it's hard to really do it every year. But, you know, it's great when we can, you know, and it's not always, and it's not always perfect, you know, but because we're people, you know, and people change. And often that's hard to face, you know, friendships changing.
Well, they're four really well-drawn characters. And what happens with women, and guys do it too, but, and this is all chauvinistic, of course, but women do the thing where they go, I love Sandra, but, you know, I really love her to death, but, and there is some of that in the book, right?
There is some of that. And then there's the pairing off, you know, it's like, okay, who's really close friends with the, you know, there's the pairing off and say a group of four or of six, or something, or it's complicated. It can get very complicated. But yeah, so, you know, you're going to have to tell me about the men. Do men do this? Guys do it too. I imagine they go off, they have their guy weekend.
I don't know. I can say I'm secure enough in my masculinity to say that I can unload on people and, you know, be emotionally open and cry and all that stuff, which actually I can, and I don't mind saying it. But for the most part, I think guys are just, you know, basically football guys, and they're going to go out on their if they went out on a trip like this, it would all be all business. And they might talk about mutual funds or their golf game or tennis, or they might talk about how miserable their lives are and how if they had a prison sentence of 20 years, at least they'd get out after 20 instead of being, you know, stuck in a marriage for 40. You know, they do that kind of stuff.
Okay, so you just went from mutual funds to talking about their marriages.
But when guys talk about marriage, it's not the same way. They just talk about it, and I'm not, well, I'm not married, so I can do it. I'm twice divorced.
But it's okay. You're safe.
Yeah, I'm safe. I can say whatever I want. So, but when they talk about marriage, guys like to, it's like the misery loves company thing. When they're on their trips, they like to talk about what they can't do because they're married.
Oh, okay.
Well, you want to hear my other theory about why men get married?
Tell me.
Okay, here's why men get married. Men get married because they're like, they've done whatever they're going to do. Then they're with this girl for like 3 or 4 years and they're on the couch. They have the remote control. They have like Fritos scoops with the Lipton French onion dip. And they're sitting there and the woman says, okay, we either get married or you get out. And the guy looks around and he's got his couch and he's got the chips and he's got
the
TV.
And he is so cozy comfy.
Yes, he's very, very comfortable. So he's like, well, yeah. Yeah, okay, I guess I'm like 30, 35. Okay, yeah, I'll do it.
Wow, you are just the romantic.
Well, I'm just being an observer. I just have...
I'm just pulling your chain. I think there's a lot of truth to that. There's a lot of truth. And so why do you think the woman asks the guy that's on the couch...
Because their girlfriends say, why don't you kick that son, you know, why don't you kick that guy out? I mean, he's just sitting there. He's not doing anything. He refuses to make a commitment of any kind at all. And she goes home and she goes, you know what? I'm going to do this. My girlfriends have told me I'm going to do this. Or she just feels like, you know, the classic biological clock is ticking. It doesn't tick for guys, and it ticks for girls, and, you know, it's 5 years. And if you go back 40 years to the old days, it's, I gave you the best 5 years of my life, you know, that kind of thing.
And he's done all the conquesting that he can kind
yes,
of manage.
Yes, yes, yeah. And but then he still feels like he's missing out after he gets married, because then his friends tell him that, you know, he can't go out with his friends drinking because he has to stay home with the kids.
It all sounds pretty hellish to me.
I know. I didn't realize.
God,
I was
what are we doing?
I don't
God.
Know. I didn't realize I was this cynical. I'm not this cynical. I don't really feel that way. I just made it all up.
That's okay. No, that's interesting.
What's everyone going to think when they hear me saying this on the radio? God.
Oh no, you might get some vicious mail. I don't know. I would go into hiding. There's a bunker in Maine I found.
There is.
Yeah, when I was doing research, I went to...
Oh, yeah, that's right, you did.
Yeah, I went for a 9-day trip. It was amazing. Yeah, I interviewed a bunch of people who live off the grid, and...
Are you doing something now for your next book? Are you doing research for your next book now?
I am. The next book takes place in the Peruvian Amazon.
Oh, cool. So, well, wait a minute. That's not that much different than this river thing.
Well, yeah, but, you know... You're bringing in the cultures and the politics, which I'm not really very interested in politics, but I mean, a political element of the story. I'm more interested in just the people, the characters, that sort of thing.
But it's still
yeah,
an adventure.
I'm going down there in July to do research.
That's great.
Yeah.
So do you think this has a shot at being a movie? Do you think someone will option it, or has it been?
Film agent, and I think he's working it. I hope something good happens. You know, it's a crazy business, though. You know, you never know.
Well, it sounds like you have some experience in it, so, you know, I thought maybe you knew.
Yeah, I mean, I've had my other book, Repeaters, was optioned for film, and it was renewed 3 times, and nothing happened. But that is the usual. In other words, the stat is that only like 1 out of 400 projects that are optioned actually become a movie or a television series. So it's best to be zen about that. And, you know, look at the movies. They're all like cartoons and superheroes, and it's becoming very corporate.
I know. It's a Marvel world of movies.
Yeah.
I mean,
and that has, quote, worldwide appeal. That's where the dough is. So, you know. I gotta keep positive, but I can't count on it. You know, I would love it. It'd be fabulous.
Yeah.
Do you know anybody?
No. It does fit into a good niche, though. I mean, it's a niche that really hasn't been explored recently, I don't think.
And what hasn't been explored?
Well, you know, a niche of 4 women on an adventure hasn't really been, you know, unless.
Yeah, I mean, you know, have you seen Descent? That was amazing.
No, I haven't.
Oh my God, Descent. Of course, they take a great movie and then they make Descent 2, which was like not very good. But I think it was 4 women, maybe 5, who went on a caving expedition, and it didn't go well.
I'll have to watch that.
Yes, you have to watch that, and then shoot me an email and tell me what you think.
Okay, I will.
Yeah, they find some people down there. Yeah, they do.
Yeah,
so but yeah, I don't think the 4 women. Oh, but you know, there's In a Dark, Dark Wood by Ruth Ware. I think it's 4 women and a guy who go on a. It's called, you know, they call it a hen, which is sort of British for bachelorette party. And you know, that does not end well either. So.
Yeah, that book goes flying off our shelf. I have an independent bookstore. And that book just flies off the shelves. I can't keep it in stock. People love it.
Yeah, I mean, it is an incredibly popular book. I'm sure it's been I know it's been optioned for film. And her next book is called Women in Cabin 10, I think. And I have not had a chance to read that yet. I'm dying to. I think women are it, man.
Yeah, it's like music, you know. I think it's finally gotten to a point where, I mean, if you think that in the past, I don't know, however long I've been doing this, probably more than half the authors I've interviewed are women, And, you know, from every type of literature, from science fiction to mystery to drama to historical fiction, it's for the first time I've really noticed that it's like on the front table of our bookstore, the bestseller, more than 50% of the books are by women, easily, I would say.
There you go. Wow. Well, and then, you know, I have to say, I mean, what are the statistics about readers? Aren't they mostly women?
Yes. And, look at my bookstore. I have, like, we're actually doing really well, which is great for an independent bookstore.
Yes, congratulations. I'm so happy to hear that.
It's hard to do. It's a pain in the ass.
yeah.
It is. I mean, you got everything working against you, but...
you do.
But luckily, we have a lot of community support, and it's in a really good place. But we have all these book clubs, and you ever notice how book clubs, you probably talk to lots of them, there's never any guys. It's just all women.
Never any guys.
Ever.
I'm going to one on Thursday.
But
And then I was just invited to one called the Boozy Broad Book Club, the BBBC. And I'm like, sign me up.
Yeah, really.
They don't even read the book. I think they just...
Guys should realize that that's where they could go to pick up women, except I think most of those women are...
Oh,
not.
God. Well, I don't know. Well, I suppose.
I have a nonfiction book club that I host. I call it Fight Club. And we have like...
Of course.
We have like 22 people in it, and there are a mixture of guys and women in that one. But that's the first one. Otherwise, it's almost exclusively women.
Okay, so why'd you call it Fight Club?
Because I like to get everyone upset with each other. My goal in the club is not really to learn anything about the book or anything. It's just to create and instigate as many possible conflicts as I can.
Yeah, otherwise it's like everyone sits around and says, this is really good, pass a snack.
Yeah, I know, or else they gossip. So I prefer to get them angry at each other. It's been something my brothers have been telling me not to do for the past 50 years or so. But I think it's too late now, you know.
No, I like it. I like it. I mean, I'm like, okay, it's a good book. Like, what? You know? And then someone says something, you know, dares to say something like, well, because I went to a book club once, and I hated the book, and it was a book everybody loved, and so I don't want to say what it is, because I'll get in trouble, but it was something about bees, you know?
Oh, I interviewed her.
Oh, don't even go there. I'm just saying bees. There's lots of books with bees in them.
And it's true, there are.
I was like, this is like, everyone's like, it's so great, made me cry. I'm like, oh my God, I mean, this is like so smarmy, and everybody looked at me like, oh, you're an awful person. And I was like, okay, pass the wine. Next book.
It sounds like an episode of Seinfeld where Elaine gets up in the middle of the movie, you know, and goes, I hate it.
I missed that. What she did? What was the movie?
It was the English Patient.
Oh, my God.
She goes, why doesn't she just die already?
I hate this movie. Yeah. So, anyway. I have been in... book clubs via Skype. That's been funny.
I know. We do
but
that
I am
too.
Going to them for real, to which is great. It's an honor, man. To be 40 books an hour are published. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
Yeah, I mean, of all different stripes. I mean, that includes nonfiction, self-published, everything. But it's very, very difficult. It's like writing a book is like climbing Mount Everest, and it's like, oh my God, then you're just standing on that mountain and you look up and guess what you see? The next Mount Everest, and that is publicity and marketing and actually selling, getting this book sold, you know?
I think a lot of authors don't realize that. First-time authors have no idea, and then, you know, they get put into this machine. And then especially the worst problem they have is if the book really takes off, like, say, Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, or Girl on a Train, or Gone Girl, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
And then their whole life is just transformed, and it's amazing.
Well, I think that's great, but I think the problem is when you're looking at those books and first making an assumption that you can just sort of, okay, sit back now and...
Right.
In your hot tub and raise your champagne. I mean, you should do that, like, you know, the first night or whatever.
Yeah. It's like,
but then you got to get back down to work and totally multitask. I mean, I'm doing this interview with you because I wanted to, but also because, you know, it's like it's like this big piece of the small piece of the pie. It's like, I want to do everything. I have to be the Energizer Bunny, you know?
Yeah, I think that's true.
To get the word out. And I so appreciate, you know, you're doing this as well. I mean, I just do it
because it's fun. And it's always enjoyable meeting people, especially when I'm talking to someone like you or we're just having a conversation. It makes it so much more fun for me. And also, what the interesting thing I would say about interviewing authors is that when I'm done interviewing them, the book kind of changes for me. And I don't know, I can't really articulate how and why, but the book becomes more, not alive, that's the wrong word, but it's as if, well, it's like when I said to you about, you know, you went back to painting and Winnie went back to painting too. It's kind of like I make a connection, you know what I mean? So I know that, I knew that was you and I knew you were her and that was something that both of you shared. And after I talk to an author, it seems like there's more of those things that I feel.
So it doesn't take away the magic?
No, it definitely doesn't. It definitely doesn't. And unless the author is a real pain in the ass, which has only been like once or twice, and I won't mention who they were, but they were real pains in the ass.
Wow. That's just not cool. They wouldn't talk to you or they said stupid stuff?
They said stupid stuff. Like I said, well, can tell us a little bit about what your book's about? And he goes, well, and that was it. And I had to stop the tape and tell him what his book was about.
So did he forget?
Yeah. He says, tell me what it's about. Tell me a little bit more about what it's about, Sam. But it wasn't like he was doing it in a gracious way. It was like he didn't really want to tell me. And I'm thinking, well, then you really don't need to be here either.
But, well, and you know, it's not a visual medium. You have to make noises.
Yes. Well, and if you're Thomas Pynchon, you don't have to, you know?
Right.
You can just...
Well, he's dead, so... but even he should make a noise if he's trying to sell his book.
True. Yeah, I would like to interview some dead authors, but...
That'd be
difficult.
So cool.
The publicists are a pain in the ass. Well, we could go on. I could talk to you all day, but I don't know if it's going to sell any more books now. We've pretty much gone through the book.
Well, I'm sure that Simon & Schuster's gone into their second printing after this conversation. I mean, you know what? I mean, geez.
I can hear the presses, yes.
I know. It's right, exactly. So,
well,
yeah.
Anyway, it's been a pleasure talking to you and getting to know you, Erica. So
yeah.
Thanks so much for being here. And then if you ever come down our way and you want to do a book signing or something like that, my producer, Rebecca, can get in touch with your publicist if you decide to head down towards Philadelphia, because we're just right outside of Philadelphia.
That sounds really fun. What I'll do is I'll email you after we're done.
Okay, that sounds great.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much. I had a blast.
Me too. Well, that was a lot of fun. That was Erica Forensic, The River at Night, which is a cool book about four girls, kind of like a chick book, but it's not a chick book at all once you get started, just an adventure book, a rollicking adventure book with all kinds of twists and turns, all of which apparently Erica planned out well in advance, and so she's a very smart, good student of literature and has written a very interesting novel that I found myself really caught up in. And I really enjoy talking with her. So keep coming by. We've had some really great shows recently. Upcoming, we have Josh Barkin, who's going to talk about his collection of short stories, which I love short stories, as you know. Mexico is the name of the book. Maxine Beneva Clark will discuss her short story collection, Foreign Soil, which is excellent and unexpectedly excellent. I went into it not knowing what to I would be experiencing, and it was really, really good. And then Alan Mustai, who's going to join us to discuss what has become a very highly anticipated debut novel called All Our Wrong Todays, which is kind of wacky science fiction, much like Steve Erickson, who we recently interviewed for his book Shadowbond. All Our Wrong Todays is about a guy who lives in this perfect world, but then he steals his father's time machine, goes back to 1965 and screws it all up. So then when he goes back to 2016, everything is not the way it was. So he spends the rest of the book trying to undo the damage that he's done. We got a bunch more, but I can't think of which ones they are now. But for a complete schedule, you can always go to WellingtonScrubBooks.com or go to the station's website, or you can download our podcast at iTunes anytime or at Podomatic. Podomatic is a cool site. And they have an app, and also you can also just, when you go to iTunes, the way it works now, you just go to podcasts and download the podcast app, and then you subscribe to ours, and all 400, 500, 600 of them are available if you want to listen to me talk for a few hundred hours. In any event, I had a very good time today talking with Erica. I hope you did too, and I look forward to having you back here next week with us here on The Avid Reader.